This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Dead Man's Walk by Larry McMurtry. Read by Will Patton.
Part 1. Matilda Jane Roberts was naked as the air. Known throughout South Texas as the Great Western, she came walking up from the muddy Rio Grande holding a big snapping turtle by the tail. Matilda was almost as large as the skinny little Mexican Mustang Gus McCrae and Woodrow Call were trying to saddle break. Call had the mare by the ears, waiting for Gus to pitch the saddle on her narrow back, but the pitch was slow in coming. When Call glanced toward the river and saw the Great Western in all her plump nakedness, he knew why. Young Gus McCrae was by nature distractible. The sight of a naked 200-pound whore carrying a full-grown snapping turtle had captured his complete attention, and that of the rest of the ranger troop as well.
"Look at that, Woodrow," Gus said. "Maddie's carrying that old turtle as if it was a basket of peaches."
"I can't look," Call said. "I'll lose my grip and get kicked, and I've done been kicked."
The mare, small though she was, had already displayed a willingness to kick and bite. Call knew that if he loosened his grip on her ears even slightly, he could count on getting kicked or bitten or both.
Long Bill Coleman, lounging against his saddle only a few yards from where the two young rangers were struggling with the little Mustang, watched Matilda approach with a certain trepidation. Although it was only an hour past breakfast, he was already drunk. It seemed to Long Bill, in his tipsy state, that the Great Western was walking directly toward him with her angry catch. It might be that she meant to use a turtle as some kind of weapon, or so Long Bill surmised. Matilda Roberts despised debt and carried grudges freely and at length. Bill knew himself to be considerably in arrears, the result of a persistent lust coupled with a vexing string of losses at cards. At the moment, he didn't have a red cent, and knew that he was unlikely to have one for days or even weeks to come. If Matilda, who was whimsical, chose to call his debt, his only recourse might be to run. But Long Bill was in no shape to run, and in any case, there was no place to run to that offered the least prospect of refuge. The rangers were camped on the Rio Grande, west of the alkaline Pecos. They were almost 300 miles from the nearest civilized habitation, and the country between them and a town was not inviting.
"When's the next payday, Major?"
Long Bill inquired, glancing at his leader, Major Randall Chevalier.
"That woman acts like she might set that turtle on me,"
he added, hoping that Major Chevalier would want to issue an order or something. Bill knew that there were military men who refused to allow whores within 100 feet of their camp, even whores not armed with snapping turtles. Major Chevalier had only spent 3 weeks at West Point. He left because he found the classes boring and the discipline vexing. He nonetheless awarded himself the rank of major after a violent scrape in Baltimore convinced him that civilian life hemmed a man in with such a passel of legalities that it was no longer worth pursuing. Randall Chevalier hit on a ship, and the ship took him to Galveston. Upon disembarking at that moist sandy port, he declared himself a major and had been a major ever since. Now, except for the two young rangers who were attempting to saddle the Mexican mare, his whole troop was drunk, the result of an incautious foray into Mexican territory the day before. They had crossed the Rio Grande out of boredom and promptly captured a donkey cart containing a few bushels of hard corn and 2 large jugs of mezcal, a liquor of such potency that it immediately unmanned several of the rangers. They had been without spirits for more than a month. They drank the mezcal like water. In fact, it tasted a good deal better than any water they had tasted since crossing the Pecos. The mezcal wasn't water, though. 2 men went blind for a while, and several others were troubled by visions of torture and dismemberment. Such visions at the time were not hard to conjure up, even without mezcal, thanks to the folly of the unfortunate Mexican whose donkey cart they had captured. Though the rangers meant the man no harm, or at least not much harm, he fled at the sight of gringos and was not even out of earshot before he fell into the hands of Comanches or Apaches,
It was impossible to tell from his screams which tribe was torturing him. All that was known was that only 3 warriors took part in the torturing. Bigfoot Wallace, the renowned scout, returned from a lengthy look around and reported seeing the tracks of 3 warriors, no more. The tracks were heading toward the river. Many rangers thought Bigfoot's point somewhat picayune. The Mexican could not have screamed louder if he had been being tortured by 50 men. The screams made sleep difficult, not to mention short. The Great Western didn't earn a cent all night. Only young Gus McCrae, whose appetite for fornication admitted no checks, approached Matilda. But of course young McCrae was penniless, and Matilda in no mood to offer credit.
"You better turn that mare loose for a while," Gus advised.
"Maddie's coming with that big turtle. I don't know what she means to do with it."
"Can't turn loose," Carl said. But then he did release the mare, jumping sideways just in time to avoid her flailing front hooves. It was clear to him that Gus had no intention of trying to saddle the mare, not any time soon. When there was a naked whore to watch, Gus was unlikely to want to do much of anything except watch the whore.
"Major, what about payday?" Long Bill inquired again.
Major Chevalier cocked an eyebrow at Long Bill Coleman, a man noted for his thorough laziness.
"Why, Bill, the mail's undependable out here beyond the Pecos," the major said. "We haven't seen a mail coach since we left San Antonio."
"Well, that whore with the darn turtle wants to be paid now,"
one-eyed Johnny Carthage speculated.
"I've never seen a whore bold enough to snatch an old turtle right out of Rio Grande River," Bob Bascom said.
In his opinion, it had been quite unmilitary for the major to allow Matilda Roberts to accompany them on their expedition, though how he would have stopped her short of gunplay was not easy to say. Matilda had simply fallen in with them when they left the settlements. She rode a large gray horse named Tom, who lost flesh rapidly once they were beyond the fertile valleys. Matilda had no fear of Indians or of anything else, not so far as Bob Bascom was aware. She helped herself liberally to the ranger's grub and conducted business on a pallet she spread in the bushes, when there were bushes. Bob had to admit that having a whore along was a convenience, but he still considered it unmilitary, though he was not so incautious as to give voice to his opinion. Major Randall Chevalier was of uncertain temper at best. Rumor had it that he had on occasions conducted summary executions acting as his own firing squad. His pistol was often in his hand, and though his leadership was erratic, his aim wasn't. He had twice brought down running antelope with his pistol. Most of the rangers couldn't have hit a running antelope with a rifle, or even a Gatling gun.
"That whore didn't snatch that turtle out of the river,"
Long Bill commented.
"I seen that turtle sleeping on a rock when I went to wash the puke off myself. She just snuck up on it, picked it off that rock. Look at it, snap at her. Now she's got it mad."
The snapper swung its neck this way and that, working its jaws, but Matilda Roberts was holding it at arm's length and its jaws merely snapped the air. "What next?" Gus said to Carl.
"I don't know what next," Carl said, a little irritated at his friend. Sooner or later they would have to take another try at saddling the mare, a chancy undertaking. "Maybe she means to cook it," Carl added.
"I have heard of slaves eating turtle," Gus said. "I believe they eat them in Mississippi."
"Well, I wouldn't eat one," Carl informed him. "I'd still like to get a saddle on this mare if you ain't too busy to help." The mare was snubbed to a low mesquite tree. She wound herself tighter and tighter as she kicked and struggled.
"Let's see what Matilda's up to first," Gus said. "We got all day to break horses."
"All right, but you'll have to take the ears this time," Carl said. "I'll do the saddling."
Matilda swung her arm a time or two and heaved the big turtle in the general direction of a bunch of rangers. The boys were cleaning their guns and musing on their headaches. They scattered like quail when they saw the turtle sailing through the air. It turned over twice and landed on its back, not 3 feet from the campfire. Bigfoot Wallace squatted by the fire. He had just finished pouring himself a cup of coffee. It was chicory coffee, but at least it was black. Bigfoot paid the turtle no attention at all. Matty Roberts had always been somewhat eccentric in his view. If she wanted to throw snapping turtles around, that was her business. He himself was occupied with more urgent concerns, one of them being the identity of the 3 warriors who had tortured the Mexican to death. A few hours after coming across their tracks, he had dozed off and dreamed a disturbing dream about Indians. In his dream, Buffalo Hump was riding a spotted horse, while Gomez walked beside him. Buffalo Hump was the meanest Comanche anyone had ever heard of, and Gomez the meanest Apache. The fact that a Comanche killer and an Apache killer were traveling together in his dream was highly unpleasant.
Never before, that he could remember, had he had a dream in which something so unlikely happened.
He almost felt he should report the dream to Major Chevalier, but the Major at the moment was distracted by Matilda Roberts and her turtle.
"Good morning, Miss Roberts. Is that your new pet?" the Major inquired when Matilda walked up.
"Nope, that's breakfast. Turtle beats bacon," Matilda said. "Has anybody got a shirt I can borrow? I left mine out by the pallet."
She had strolled down to the river naked because she felt like having a wash in the cold water. It wasn't deep enough to swim in, but she gave herself a good splashing. The old snapper just happened to be lazing on a rock nearby, so she grabbed it. Half the rangers were scared of Matilda anyway, some so scared they would scarcely look at her, naked or clothed. The Major wasn't scared of her, nor was Bigfoot or Young Gus. The rest of the men, in her view, were incompetents, the kind of men who were likely to run up debts and get killed before they could pay them. She sailed the snapper in their direction to let them know she expected honest behavior. Going naked didn't hurt either. She was big and liked it. She could punch most men out if she had to, and sometimes she had to. Her dream was to get to California and own a fine bordello, which was why she fell in with the first ranger troop going west. It was a scraggly little troop composed mostly of drunks and shiftless ramblers, but she took it and was making the best of it. The alternative was to wait in Texas, get old, and never own a bordello in California. At her request, several rangers immediately began to take off their shirts, but Bigfoot Wallace made no move to remove his, and his was the only shirt large enough to cover much of Maddie Roberts.
"I guess you won't be sashaying around naked much longer, Maddie," he observed, sipping his chicory.
"Why not? I ain't stingy about offering my customers a look," Matilda said, rejecting several of the proffered shirts.
Bigfoot nodded toward the north, where a dark tone on the horizon contrasted with the bright sunlight.
"One of our fine blue northers is about to whistle in," he informed her. "You'll have icicles hanging off your twat in another hour if you don't cover it up."
"I wouldn't need to cover it up if anyone around here was prosperous enough to warm it up," Matilda said, but she did note that the northern horizon had turned a dark blue.
Several rangers observed the same fact and began to pull on long johns or other garments that might be of use against a norther. Bigfoot Wallace was known to have an excellent eye for weather. Even Matilda respected it. She strolled over to her pallet and pulled on a pair of blacksmith's overalls that she had taken in payment for a brief engagement in Fredericksburg. She had a tattered capote, acquired some years earlier in Pennsylvania, and she put that on too. A blue norther could quickly suck the warmth out of the air even on a nice sunny day.
"Well, we've conquered a turtle, I guess," Major Chevalier said, standing up. "I suppose that Mexican died. I don't hear much noise from across the river."
"If he's lucky, he died," Bigfoot said. "It was just three Indians. Comanches, I'd figure. I doubt three Comanches would pause more than one night to cut up a Mexican."
About that time, Josh Korn and Ezekiel Moody came walking back to camp from the sand hill where they had been standing guard. Josh Korn was a little man, only about half the size of his tall friend. Both were surprised to see a sizable snapping turtle kicking its legs in the air not much more than arm's length from the coffee pot.
"Why is everybody dressing up? Is there going to be a parade?"
Josh asked, noting that several rangers were in the process of pulling on clothes.
"That Mexican didn't have no way to kill himself," Bob Bascom remarked. "He didn't have no gun."
"No, but he had a knife," Bigfoot reminded him. "A knife's adequate if you know where to cut."
"Where would you cut, I've wondered?"
Gus asked, abruptly leaving Call to contemplate the Mexican Mustang alone. He was a ranger on the wild frontier now and needed to imbibe as much technical information as possible about methods of suicide when in danger of capture by hostiles with a penchant for torture.
"No Comanche's going to be quick enough to sew up your jugular vein if you whack it through in two or three places," Bigfoot said. Aware that several of the rangers were inexpert in such matters, he stretched his long neck and put his finger on the spot where the whacking should be done. "It's right here," he said. "You could even poke into it with a big mesquite thorn or whack at it with a broken bottle if you left without no knife."
Long Bill Coleman felt a little queasy, partly because of the mezcal and partly from the thought of having to stick a thorn in his neck in order to avoid Comanche torture.
"Me, I'll shoot myself in the head if I've got time," Long Bill said.
"Well, but that can go wrong," Bigfoot informed him.
Once set in an instructional direction, he didn't like to turn until he had given a thorough lecture. Bigfoot considered himself to be practical to a fault. If a man had to kill himself in a hurry, it was best to know exactly how to proceed.
Don't go sticking no gun in your mouth unless it's a shotgun, he advised, noting that Long Bill looked a little green. Probably the alkaline water didn't agree with him.
Why not? It's hard to miss your head if you got a gun in your mouth, Ezekiel Moody commented.
No, it ain't, Bigfoot said. The bullet could glance off a bone and come out your ear. You'd still be healthy enough that they could torture you for a week. Shove the barrel of the gun up against an eyeball and pull. That's sure. Your brains will get blown out the back of your head. Then if some squaw comes along and chews off your balls and pecker, you won't know the difference.
My, this is cheery conversation, Major Chevalier said. I wish Matilda would come back and remove this turtle.
I'd like to go back and have another look at them tracks, Bigfoot said. It was about dark when I seen them. Another look couldn't hurt.
It could hurt if the Comanches that got that Mexican caught you,
Josh Coyne remarked.
Why, those boys are halfway to the Brazos by now, Bigfoot said, just as Matilda returned to the campfire.
She squatted down by the turtle and watched it wiggle, a happy expression on her broad face. She had a hatchet in one hand and a small bowie knife in the other.
Them turtles don't turn loose of you till it thunders once they got a hold of you, Ezekiel said.
Matilda Roberts ignored this hackneyed opinion. She caught the turtle right by the head, held its jaws shut, and slashed its neck with the little bowie knife. The whole company watched, even Carl. Several of the men had traveled the western frontier all their lives. They considered themselves to be experienced men, but none of them had ever seen a whore decapitate a snapping turtle before. Blackie Slidell watched Matilda slash at the turtle's neck with a glazed expression. The mescal had caused him to lose his vision entirely for several hours. In fact, it was still somewhat wobbly. Blackie had an unusual birthmark. His right ear was coal black, thus his name. Although he couldn't see very well, Blackie was not a little disturbed by Bigfoot's chance remark about the chewing propensities of Comanche squaws. He had long heard of such things, of course, but had considered them to be unfounded rumor. Bigfoot Wallace, though, was the authority on Indian customs. His comment could not be ignored, even if everybody else was watching Matilda cut the head off her turtle.
"Hell, if we see Indians, let's kill all the squaws," Blackie said indignantly. "They got no call to be behaving like that."
"Oh, there's worse than that, Adams," Bigfoot remarked casually, noting that the turtle's blood seemed to be green, if it had blood. A kind of green ooze dripped out of the wound Matilda had made. She herself was finding the turtle's neck a difficult cut. She gave the turtle's head two or three twists, hoping it would snap off like a chicken's would, but the turtle's neck merely kinked like a thick black rope.
"What's worse than having your pecker chewed off?" Blackie inquired.
"Oh, having them pull out the end of your gut and tie it to a dog," Bigfoot said, pouring himself more chicory. "Then they chase a dog around the camp for a while until about 50 feet of your gut is strung out in front of you for brats to eat."
"To eat?"
Long Bill asked.
"Why, yes," Bigfoot said. "Comanche brats eat gut like ours eat candy." "Phew, I'm glad I wasn't especially hungry this morning," Major Chevalier commented. "Talk like this would unsettle a delicate stomach."
"Or they might run a stick up your fundament and set it on fire. That way your guts would done be cooked when they pull them out," Bigfoot explained.
"What's a fundament?" Carl asked. He had only 1 year of schooling and had not encountered the word in his speller. He kept the speller with him in his saddlebag and referred to it now and then when in doubt about a letter or a word. Bob Bascom snorted, amused by the youngster's ignorance.
"There's a hole in your body and it ain't your nose or your mouth or your goddamn ear," Bob said. "I'd have that little mare broke by now if it was me doing it."
Carl smarted at the rebuke. He knew they had been lax with the mare, who had now effectively snubbed herself to the little tree. She was trembling, but she couldn't move far, so he quickly swung the saddle in place and held it there while she crow-hopped a time or two. Matilda Roberts sweated over her task, but she didn't give up. The first gusts of the norther scattered the ashes of the campfire. Major Chevalier had just squatted to refill his cup. His coffee soon had a goodly sprinkling of sand. When the turtle's head finally came off, Matilda casually pitched it in the direction of Long Bill, who jumped as if she'd thrown him a live rattler. The turtle's angry eyes were still wide open, and its jaws continued to snap with a sharp click.
"It ain't even dead with its head off," Long Bill said, annoyed.
Shadrach, the oldest ranger, a tall, grizzled specimen with a cloudy past, walked over to the turtle's head and squatted down to study it. Shadrach rarely spoke, but he was by far the most accurate rifle shot in the troop.
He owned a fine Kentucky rifle with a cherrywood stock and was contemptuous of the bulky carbines most of the troop had adopted. Shadrach found a little mesquite stick and held it in front of the turtle's head. The turtle's beak immediately snapped onto the stick, but the stick didn't break. Shadrach picked up the little stick with the turtle's head attached to it and dropped it in the pocket of his old black coat. Josh Korn was astonished.
"Why would you keep a thing like that?"
he asked Shadrach, but the old man took no interest in the question.
"Why would he keep a smelly old turtle's head?"
Josh asked Bigfoot Wallace.
"Why would Gomez raid with Buffalo Hump?" Bigfoot asked. "That's a better question."
Matilda, by this time, had hacked through the turtle shell with her hatchet and was cutting the turtle meat into strips. Watching her slice the green meat caused Long Bill Coleman to get the queasy feeling again. Young Call, though nicked by a rear hoof, had succeeded in cinching the saddle onto the Mexican mare. Major Chevalier was sipping his ashy coffee. Already the new wind from the north had begun to cut. He hadn't been paying much attention to the half-drunken campfire palaver, but between one sip of coffee and the next, Bigfoot's question brought him out of his reverie.
"What did you say about Buffalo Hump?" he asked. "I wouldn't suppose that scoundrel is anywhere around."
"Well, he might be," Bigfoot said.
"But what was it that you said just now?" the major asked. "It's hard to concentrate with Matilda cutting up this ugly turtle."
"I had a darn dream," Bigfoot admitted. "In my dream, Gomez was raiding with Buffalo Hump."
"Nonsense. Gomez is Apache," the major said.
Bigfoot didn't answer. He knew that Gomez was Apache and that Apache didn't ride with Comanche. That was not the normal order of things. Still, he had dreamed what he dreamed. If Major Chevalier didn't enjoy hearing about it, he could sip his coffee and keep quiet. The whole troop fell silent for a moment. Just hearing the names of the two terrible warriors was enough to make the Rangers reflect on the uncertainties of their calling, which were considerable.
"I don't like that part about the guts," Long Bill said. "I aim to keep my own guts inside me if nobody minds."
Shadrach was saddling his horse. He felt free to leave the troop at will, and his absences were apt to last a day or two.
"Shad, are you leaving?" Bigfoot asked. "We're all leaving," Shadrach said. "There's Indians to the north. I smell 'em."
"I thought I still gave the orders around here," Major Chevalier said. "I don't know why you would have such a dream, Wallace. Why would those two devils raid together?"
"I've dreamt prophecy before," Bigfoot said. "Shad's right about the Indians. I smell 'em, too."
"What's this? Where are they?"
Major Chevalier asked, just as the norther hit with its full force.
There was a general scramble for guns and cover. Long Bill Coleman found the anxiety too much for his overburdened stomach. He grabbed his rifle, but then had to bend and puke before he could seek cover. The cold wind swirled white dust through the camp. Most of the Rangers had taken cover behind little hummocks of sand or chaparral bushes. Only Matilda was unaffected. She continued to lay strips of greenish turtle meat onto the campfire. The first cuts were already dripping and crackling.
Old Shadrach mounted and went galloping north, his long rifle across his saddle. Bigfoot Wallace grabbed a rifle and vanished into the sage.
"What do we do with this mare, Gus?" Call asked. He'd only been a ranger 6 weeks. His one problem with the work was that it was almost impossible to get precise instructions in time of crisis. Now he finally had the Mexican mare saddled, but everyone in camp was lying behind sand hills with their rifles ready. Even Gus had grabbed his old gun and taken cover. Major Chevalier was attempting to unhobble his horse, but he had no dexterity and was making a slow job of it.
"You boys, come help me," he yelled.
From the precipitate behavior of Shadrach and Bigfoot, the most experienced men in the troop, he assumed that the camp was in danger of being overrun. Gus and Carl ran to the major's aid. The wind was so cold that Gus even thought it prudent to button the top button of his flannel shirt.
"God damn this wind," the major said.
During breakfast, he had been rereading a letter from his dear wife, Jane. He had read the letter at least 20 times, but it was the only letter he had with him, and he did love his winsome Jane. When the business about Gomez and Buffalo Hump came up, he had casually stuffed the letter in his coat pocket, but he didn't get it in securely, and now the whistling wind had snatched it. It was a long letter. His dear Jane was lavish with detail of circumstances back in Virginia, and now several pages of it were blowing away in the general direction of Mexico.
"Here, boys, fetch my letter," the major said. "I can't afford to lose my letter. I'll finish saddling this horse."
Carl and Gus left the major to finish cinching his saddle on his big sorrel and began to chase the letter, some of which had sailed quite a distance downwind. Both of them kept looking over their shoulders, expecting to see the Indians charging. Carl had not had time to fetch his rifle. His only weapon was a pistol. Thanks to his efforts with the mayor, the talk of torture and suicide had been hard to follow. Carl liked to do things correctly, but was in doubt as to the correct way to dispatch himself should he suddenly be surrounded by Comanches. "What was it Bigfoot said about shooting out your brains?" he asked Gus, his lanky pal. Gus had run down 4 pages of the major's lengthy letter. Carl had 3 pages. Gus didn't seem to be particularly concerned about the prospect of Comanche capture. His nonchalant approach to life could be irksome in times of conflict. "I'd go help Maddie clean her turtle if I thought she'd give me a poke," Gus said. "Gus, there's Indians coming," Carl said. "Just tell me what Bigfoot said about shooting out your brains. That whore don't need no help with that turtle," he added.
"Oh, you're supposed to shoot through the eyeball," Gus said. "I'll be damned if I would, though. I need both eyes to look at whores."
"I should have kept my rifle handier," Carl said, annoyed with himself for having neglected sound procedure. "Do you see any Indians yet?"
"No, but I see Josh Corn taking a shit,"
Gus said, pointing at their friend Josh. He was squatting behind a sage bush, rifle at the ready, while he did his business.
"I guess he must think it's his last chance before he gets scalped,"
Gus added. Major Chevalier jumped on his sorrel and started to race after Shadrach, but had scarcely cleared the camp before he reined in his horse. Carl could just see him in the swirling dust. The plain to the north of the camp had become a wall of sand. "I wonder how we can get some money. I sure do need a poke," Gus said. He had turned his back to the wind and was casually reading the major's letter, an action that shocked Carl. "That's the major's letter," he pointed out. "You got no business reading it."
"Well, don't say much anyway," Gus said, handing the pages to Carl. "I thought it might be racy, but it ain't."
"If I ever write a letter, I don't want to catch you reading it," Carl said. "I think Shad's coming back." His eyes were stinging from staring into the dust. There seemed to be figures approaching camp from the north. Carl couldn't make them out clearly, and Gus didn't seem to be particularly interested. Once he began to think about whores, he had a hard time pulling his mind off the subject.
"If we could catch a Mexican, we could steal his money. He might have enough that we could buy quite a few pokes," Gus said as they strolled back to camp.
Major Chevalier waited on his sorrel, watching. 2 figures seemed to be walking. Then Bigfoot fell in with them. Shadrach appeared on his horse a few steps behind the figures. All around the camp, rangers began to stand up and dust the sand off their clothes. Matilda, unaffected by the crisis, was still cooking her turtle. The bloody shell lay by the campfire. Carl smelled the sizzling meat and realized he was hungry. "Why, it's just an old woman and a boy," he said, when he finally got a clear view of the 2 figures trudging through the sandstorm, flanked on one side by Shadrach and on the other by Bigfoot Wallace.
"Shoot, I doubt either one of them has got a scent on them," Gus said. "I think we ought to sneak off across the river and catch a Mexican while it's still early."
"Just wait," Carl said. He was anxious to see the captives, if they were captives.
"I swear," Long Bill said, "I think that old woman's blind. That boy's leading her."
Long Bill was right. A boy of about 10, who looked more Mexican than Indian, walked slowly toward the campfire, leading an old white-haired woman. Carl had never seen anyone who looked as old as the old woman. When they came close enough to the fire to smell the sizzling meat, the boy began to make a strange sound. It wasn't speech, exactly. It was more like a moan.
"What's he wanting?" Matilda asked. She was unnerved by the sound.
"Why, a slice or two of your turtle meat, I expect," Bigfoot said. "More than likely he's hungry."
"Then why don't he ask?" Matilda said.
"He can't ask, Matilda," Bigfoot said.
"Why not? Ain't he got a tongue?"
Matilda asked.
"Nope. No tongue," Bigfoot said. "Somebody cut it out."
The north wind blew harder, hurling the sands and soils of the great plain of Texas toward Mexico. It soon obliterated vision. Shadrach and Major Chevalier mounted could not see the ground. Men could not see across the campfire. Carl found his rifle, but when he tried to sight, discovered that he could not see to the end of the barrel. The sand peppered them like fine shot, and it rode a cold wind. The horses could only turn their backs to it. So did the men. Most put their saddles over their heads and their saddle blankets, too. Matilda's bloody turtle shell soon filled with sand. The campfire was almost smothered. Men formed a human wall to the north of it to keep it from guttering out. Bigfoot and Shadrach tied bandanas around their faces. Long Bill had a bandana, but it blew away and was never found. Matilda gave up cooking and sat with her back to the wind, her head bent between her knees. The boy with no tongue reached into the guttering campfire and took two slices of the sizzling turtle meat. One he gave to the old blind woman. Although the meat was tough and scalding, he gulped his portion in only 3 bites. Kirker and Glanton, the scalp hunters, sat together with their backs to the wind. They stared through the fog of sand, appraising the boy and the old woman. Kirker took out his scalping knife and a small whetstone. He tried to spit on the whetstone, but the wind took the spit away. Kirker began to sharpen the knife anyway. The old woman turned her sightless eyes toward the sound. She spoke to the boy in a language Carl had never heard, but the boy had no tongue and couldn't answer. Even through the howling of the wind, Carl could hear the grinding sound as Kirker whetted his scalping knife. Gus heard it too, but his mind had not moved very far from his favorite subject, whores.
"Be hard to poke in a wind like this," he surmised. "Your whore would fill up with sand. Unless you went careful, you'd scrape yourself raw."
Carl ignored this comment, thinking it foolish. "Kirker and Glanton ain't rangers. I don't know why the major lets them ride with the troop," he said.
"It's a free country. How could he stop them?"
Gus asked, though he had to admit that the scalp hunters were unsavory company. Their gear smelled of blood, and they never washed. Gus agreed with Matilda that it was good to keep clean. He splashed himself regularly if there was water available. "He could shoot them. I'd shoot them if I was in command," Carl said. "They're low killers, in my opinion." Only the day before, there had nearly been a ruckus with Kirker and Glanton. The two came riding in from the south, having taken 8 scalps. The scalps hung from Kirker's saddle. A buzzing cloud of flies surrounded them, although the blood on the scalps had dried. Most of the rangers gave Kirker a wide berth. He was a thin man with 3 gappy teeth, which gave his smile a cruel twist. Glanton was larger and lazier. He slept more than anyone else in the troop and would even fall asleep and start snoring while mounted on his horse. Shadrach had no fear of either man, and neither did Bigfoot Wallace. When Kirker dismounted, Shadrach and Bigfoot walked to examine his trophies. Shadrach fingered one of the scalps and looked at Bigfoot, who swatted the clouds of flies away briefly and sniffed a time or two at the hair.
"Comanche, who said you could smell him?"
Kirker asked. He was chewing on some antelope jerky that Black Sam the cook had provided. The sight of the old mountain man and the big scout handling his new trophies annoyed him.
"We picked all 8 of them off at a water hole," Glenn said. "I shot 4 and so did John."
"That's a pure lie," Bigfoot said. 8 Comanches could string you and Kirker out from here to Santa Fe. If you was ever unlucky enough to run into that maid once, we wouldn't be having to smell your damn stink anymore." He waved at Major Chevalier, who strolled over looking uncomfortable. He drew his pistol, a precaution the Major always took when he sensed controversy. With his pistol drawn, decisive judgment could be reached and reached quickly. "These low dogs have been killing Mexicans, Major," Bigfoot said. "They probably took supper with some little family and then shot them all and took their hair."
"That would be unneighborly behavior, if true," Major Chevalier said. He looked at the scalps but didn't touch them.
"This ain't Indian hair," Shadrach said. "Indian hair smells Indian, but this don't. This hair is Mexican." "It's Comanche hair, and you can both go to hell," Kirker said. "If you need a ticket, I can provide it."
The gap-toothed Kirker carried 3 pistols and a knife and usually kept his rifle in the crook of his arm where it was now.
"Sit down, Kirker. I'll not have you roughhousing with my scouts," the Major said.
"Roughhousing hell,"
Kirker said. He flushed red when he was angry, and a blue vein popped out alongside his nose.
"I'll finish them right here if they don't leave my scalps alone," he added.
Glanton had his eyes only half open, but his hand was on his pistol, a fact both Bigfoot and Shadrach ignored.
"There's no grease, Major," Bigfoot said. "Indians grease the hair. Take a Comanche scalp and you'll have grease up to your elbow. Kirker ain't even sly. He could have greased this hair if he wanted to fool us, but he didn't. I expect he was too lazy."
"Get away from them scalps. They're government property now,"
Kirker said.
"I took them and I intend to collect my bounty."
Shadrach looked at the Major. He didn't believe the Major was firm, although it was undeniable that he was an accurate shot.
If a Mexican posse shows up, let him have these two, he advised. This ain't Indian hair, and what's more, it ain't grown-up hair. These two went over to Mexico and killed a passel of children. Kirker merely sneered.
Hair's hair, he said. This is government property now, and you're welcome to keep your goddamn hands off it.
Carl and Gus waited, expecting the major to shoot Kirker, and possibly Glanton, too. But the major didn't shoot. Bigfoot and Shadrach walked away, disgusted. Shadrach mounted, crossed the river, and was gone for several hours. Kirker kept on chewing his antelope jerky, and Glanton was sound asleep, leaning against his horse. Major Chevalier did look at Kirker hard. He knew he ought to shoot the two men and leave them to the flies. Shadrach's opinion was no doubt accurate. The men had been killing Mexican children. Mexican children were a lot easier to hunt than Comanches. But the major didn't shoot. His troop was in an uncertain position, liable to attack at any minute, and Kirker and Glanton made two more fighting men, adding two guns to the company's meager strength. If there was a serious scrape, one or both of them might be killed anyway. If not, they could always be executed at a later date.
"Stay this side of the river from now on," the major said. He still had his pistol in his hand. "If either of you cross it again, I'll hunt you down like dogs."
Kirker didn't flinch.
"We ain't dogs, though. We're wolves. At least I am. You won't be catching me if I go. As for Glanton, you can have him. I'm tired of listening to his goddamn snores."
Gus soon forgot the incident, but Carl didn't. He listened to Kirker sharpen his knife and wished he had the authority to kill the man himself. In his view, Kirker was a snake, and worse than a snake. If you discovered a snake in your bedclothes, the sensible thing would be to kill it. Major Chevalier had looked right at the snake, but hadn't killed it. The sandstorm blew for another hour, until the camp and everything in it was covered with sand. When it finally blew out, men discovered that they couldn't find utensils that they had carelessly laid down before the storm began. The sky overhead was a cold blue. The plain in all directions was level with sand. Only the tops of sage bushes and chaparral broke the surface. The Rio Grande was murky and brown. The little mare, still snubbed to the tree, was in sand up to her knees. All the men stripped naked in order to shake as much sand as possible out of their clothes, but more sand filtered in, out of the hair and off their collars. Gus brushed the branch of a mesquite tree and a shower of sand rained down on him. Only the old Indian woman and the boy with no tongue made no attempt to rid themselves of sand. The fire had finally been smothered, but the old woman and the boy still sat by it, sand banked against their backs. To Carl, they hardly seemed human. They were like part of the ground. Gus, in high spirits, decided to be a bronc rider after all. He took it into his head to ride the Mexican mare.
"I expect that storm's got her cowed," he said to Carl.
"Gus, she ain't cowed," Carl said. He had the mare by the ears again and detected no change in her attitude. Sure enough, the mare threw Gus on the second jump. Several of the naked rangers laughed and went on shaking out their clothes. In the early afternoon, still carrying more sand in his clothes than he would have liked, Major Chevalier attempted to question the old woman and the boy. He gave them coffee and fed them a little hardtack first, hoping it would make them talkative, but the feast, such as it was, failed in its purpose, mainly because no one in the troop spoke any Comanche. The Major had supposed Bigfoot Wallace to be adept in the tongue, but Bigfoot firmly denied any knowledge of it.
"Why, no, Major," Bigfoot said. "I've made it a practice to stay as far away from the Comanche as I can get," Bigfoot said. "What few I ever met face on, I shot. Some others have shot at me, but we never stopped to palaver."
The old woman wore a single bear tooth on a rawhide cord around her neck. The tooth was the size of a small pocket knife. Several of the men looked at it with envy. Most of them would have been happy to own a bear tooth that large.
"She must have been a chief's woman," Long Bill speculated. "Otherwise, why would a squaw get to keep a fine grizzly tooth like that?"
Matilda Roberts knew five or six words of Comanche and tried them all on the old woman without result. The old woman sat where she had settled when she walked into the camp, backed by a hummock of sand. Her rheumy eyes were focused on the campfire, or on what had been the campfire. The tongueless boy, still hungry, dug most of the sandy turtle meat out of the ashes of the campfire and ate it. No one contested him. although Matilda dusted the sand off a piece or two and gnawed at the meat herself. The boy perked up considerably once he had eaten the better part of Matilda's snapping turtle. He did his best to talk, but all that came out were moans and gurgles. Several of the men had tried to talk to him in sign, but got nowhere.
"God damn Shadrach, where did he go?" the major asked. "We've got a Comanche captive here, and the only man we have who speaks Comanche leaves."
As the day wore on, Gus and Carl took turns getting pitched off the mare. Carl once managed to stay on her 5 hops, which was the best either of them achieved. The rangers soon lost interest in watching the boys get pitched around. A few got up a card game. Several others took a little target practice using cactus apples as targets. Bigfoot Wallace pared his toenails, several of which had turned coal black as the result of his having worn foot gear too small for his feet. It was that or go barefooted, and in the thorny country they were in, bare feet would have been a handicap. Towards sundown, Carl and Gus were assigned first watch. They took their position behind a good clump of chaparral a quarter of a mile north of the camp. Major Chevalier had been making another attempt to converse with the old Comanche woman as they were leaving camp. He tried sign, but the old woman looked at him absent, indifferent. "Shadrach just rode off and he ain't rode back," Carl said. "I feel better when Shadrach's around."
"I'd feel better if there were more whores,"
Gus commented. In the afternoon he had made another approach to Matilda Roberts, only to be rebuffed.
"I should have stayed on the riverboats," he added. "I never lack for whores on the riverboats."
Carl was watching the north. He wondered if it was really true that Shadrach and Bigfoot could smell Indians. Of course, if you got close to an Indian, or to anybody, you could smell them. There were times on sweaty days when he could easily smell Gus, or any other ranger happened to be close by. Black Sam, the cook, had a fairly strong smell, and so did Ezekiel. The latter had not bothered to wash the whole time Carl had known him. But dirt and sweat weren't what Bigfoot and Shadrach had been talking about when they said they smelled Indians. The old woman and the boy had been nearly a mile away when they claimed to smell them. Surely not even the best scout could smell a person that far away.
"There could have been more Indians out there when Shad said he smelled them," Carl speculated. "There could be a passel out there, just waiting."
Gus McCrae took guard duty a good deal more lightly than his companion Woodrow Carl. He looked at his time on guard as a welcome escape from the chores that cropped up around camp, gathering firewood, for example, or chopping it, or saddle-soaping the major's saddle. Since he and Woodrow were the youngest rangers in the troop, they were naturally expected to do most of the chores. Several times they'd even been required to shoe horses, although Black Sam, the cook, was also a more than adequate blacksmith. Gus found such tasks irksome. He believed he had been put on earth to enjoy himself, and there was no enjoyment to be derived from shoeing horses. Horses were heavy animals. Most of the ones he shoed had a tendency to lean on him once he picked up a foot. Drinking mezcal was far more to his liking. In fact, he had a few swallows left in a small jug he had managed to appropriate. He had kept the jug buried in the sand all day, lest some thirsty ranger discover it and drain the mezcal. He owned a woolen serape purchased in a stall in San Antonio and had managed to sneak the jug out of camp under the serape. When he brought it out and took a swig, Carl looked annoyed.
"If the major caught you drinking on guard, he'd shoot you," Carl said.
It was true, too. The major tolerated many foibles in his troop, but he did demand sobriety of the men assigned to keep guard. They were camped not far from the great Comanche war trail. The merciless raiders from the north could appear at any moment. Even momentary inattention on the part of the guards could imperil the whole troop.
"Well, but how could he catch me?" Gus asked. "He's trying to talk to that old woman. He'd have to sneak up on us to catch me, and I'd have to be drunker than this not to notice a fat man sneaking up."
It was certainly true that Major Chevalier was fat. He outweighed Matilda by a good 50 pounds, and Matilda was not small. The major was short, too, which made his girth all the more noticeable. Still, he was the major. Just because he hadn't shot the scalp hunters didn't mean he wouldn't shoot Gus.
"I don't believe you was ever on a riverboat. Why would they hire you?" Carl asked.
At times of irritation, he began to remember all the lies Gus had told him. Gus McCrae had no more regard for truth than he did for the rules of rangering.
"Well, of course I was," Gus said. "I was a top pilot for a darn year. I'm a Tennessee boy. I can run one of them riverboats as well as the next man. I only run aground once in all the time I worked."
The truth of that was that he had once sneaked aboard a riverboat for 2 days. When he was discovered, he was put off on a mud bar near Dubuque. A young whore had hidden him for the 2 days. The captain had roundly chastised her when Gus was discovered. Shortly after he was put off, the riverboat ran aground. That was the one true fact in the story. The tale sounded grand to his green friend, though. Woodrow Call had got no farther in the world than his uncle's scratchy farm near Navasota. Woodrow's parents had been taken by the smallpox, which is why he was raised by the uncle, a tyrant who stropped him so hard that when Woodrow got old enough to follow the road to San Antonio, he ran off. It was in San Antonio that the two of them had met, or rather that Call had found Gus asleep against the wall of a saloon near the river. Call worked for a Mexican blacksmith at the time, stirring the forge and helping the old smith with the horseshoeing that went on from dawn till dark. The Mexican, Jesus, a kindly old man who hummed sad harmonies all day as he worked, allowed Call to sleep on a pallet of nail sacks in a small shed behind the forge. Blacksmithing was dirty work. Call had been on his way to the river to wash off some of the smudge from his work when he noticed a lanky youth, sound asleep against the wall of the little adobe saloon. At first he thought the stranger might be dead, so profound were his slumbers. Killings were not uncommon in the streets of San Antonio. Call thought he ought to stop and check, since if the boy was dead, it would have to be reported. It turned out, though, that Gus was merely so fatigued that he was beyond caring whether he was counted among the living or among the dead. He had traveled in a tight stagecoach for 9 days and 9 nights, making the trip from Baton Rouge through the pines of East Texas to San Antonio. Upon arrival, his fellow passengers decided that Gus had been with them long enough. He was in such a stupor of fatigue that he offered no resistance when they rolled him out. He could not remember how long he had been sleeping against the saloon. It was his impression that he had slept about a week. That night, Call let Gus share his pallet of nail sacks, and the two had been friends ever since. It was Gus who decided they should apply for the Texas Rangers. Call would never have thought himself worthy of such a position. It was Gus, too, who boldly approached the major when word got out that a troop was being formed whose purpose, other than hanging whatever horse thieves or killers turned up, was to explore a stage route to El Paso. Fortunately, Major Chevalier had not been hard to convince. He took one look at the two healthy-looking boys and hired them at the princely sum of $3 a month. They would be furnished with mounts, blankets, and a rifle apiece. Departure was immediate. Saddles proved to be the main problem. Neither Gus or Call had a saddle, or a pistol either. Finally, the major intervened on their behalf with an old German who owned a hardware store and saddle shop, the back of which was piled with single-tree saddles in bad repair and guns of every description, most of which didn't work. Finally, two pistols were extracted that looked as if they might shoot if primed a little, and also two single-tree rigs with tattered leather that the German agreed to part with for $1 apiece, pistols thrown in. Major Chevalier advanced the $2, and the next morning at dawn, he, Call, Gus, Shadrach, Bob Bascom, Long Bill Coleman, Ezekiel Moody, Josh Korn, One-Eyed Johnny Carthage, Blackie Slidell, Rip Green, and Black Sam, leading his kitchen mule, trotted out of San Antonio. Call had never been so happy in his life. Overnight, he had become a Texas Ranger, the grandest thing anyone could possibly be. Gus, though, was irritated at the lack of ceremony attending their departure. A scabby dog barked a few times, but no inhabitants lined the streets to cheer them on. Gus thought there should at least have been a bugler. "I'd blow a bugle myself if one was available," he said. Call thought the remark wrong-headed. Even if they had a bugle, and if Gus could blow it, who would listen to it except a few Mexicans and a donkey or two? It was enough that they were Rangers. 2 days before, they had simply been homeless boys. Bigfoot Wallace, the scout, didn't catch up until the next day. At the time of their departure, he had been in jail. Apparently, he had thrown a deputy sheriff out the second-floor window of the community's grandest whorehouse. The deputy suffered a broken collarbone, an annoyance sufficient to cause the sheriff to jail Bigfoot for a week. Gus McCrae, a newcomer to Texas, had never heard of Bigfoot Wallace and saw no reason to be awed. Throwing a deputy sheriff out a window did not seem to him to be a particularly impressive feat. "Now, if he'd thrown the governor out, that would have been a fine thing," Gus said. Call thought his friend's comment absurd. Why would the governor be in a whorehouse anyway? Bigfoot Wallace was the most respected scout on the Texas frontier. Even in Navasota, far to the east, Bigfoot's name was known and his exploits talked about. "They say he's been all the way to China," Call explained. "He knows every creek in Texas and whether it's boggy or not, and he's a first-rate Indian killer besides." Myself, I'd rather know every whore, Gus said. You can have a lot more fun with whores than you can with governors.
Carl had seen several whores on the street, but had never visited one. Although he had the inclination, he never had the money. Gus McCrae, though, seemed to have spent his life in the company of whores. Though he had once mentioned that he had a mother and three sisters back in Tennessee, he preferred to talk mainly about whores, often to the point of tedium. Carl, though, had the greatest respect for Bigfoot Wallace. He intended to study the man and learn as many of his wilderness skills as possible. Though most of the older rangers were well versed in woodcraft, Bigfoot and Shadrach were clearly the two masters. If the company came to a fork in a creek or river while the scouts were ranging ahead, the company waited until one of them showed up and told it which fork to take. Major Chevalier had never been west of San Antonio. Once they left the settlements behind and started toward the Pecos, he allowed his accomplished scouts to choose a route. It was Shadrach who took them south, into the lonely country of sage and sand, where the two boys were now crouched behind their chaparral bush. In San Antonio, there had been talk that war with Mexico was brewing. Early on, the major had instructed the troop to fire on any Mexican who seemed hostile.
"Better to be safe than sorry," he said, and many heads nodded.
In fact, though, the only Mexican they had seen was the unfortunate driver of the donkey cart. In the western reaches, no one was quite certain where Mexico stopped and Texas began. The Rio Grande made a handy border, but neither Major Chevalier nor anyone else considered it to be particularly official. Mexicans, hostile or otherwise, didn't occupy much of the troops' attention, almost all of which was reserved for the Comanches. Call had yet to see a Comanche Indian, though throughout the trek, Long Bill, Rip Green, and other rangers had assured him that the Comanches were sure to show up in the next hour or two, bent on scalping and torture.
"I wonder how big Comanches are," he asked Gus as they peered north into the silent darkness.
"About the size of Matilda, I've heard," Gus said.
"That old woman ain't the size of Matilda," Carl pointed out. "She's no taller than Rip." Rip Green was the smallest ranger, standing scarcely 5 feet high. He also lacked a thumb on his right hand, having shot it off himself while cleaning a pistol he'd neglected to unload.
"Yes, but she's old, Woodrow," Gus said. "I expect she's shriveled up."
He'd just consumed the last of his mezcal and was feeling gloomy at the thought of a long watch with no liquor. At least he had a serape, though. Carl had no coat. He intended to purchase one with his first wages. He owned two shirts and wore them both on frosty mornings when the thorns of the chaparral bushes were rimmed with white. Just then, a wolf howled far to the north where they were looking. Another wolf joined the first one. Then nearer by there was the yip of a coyote.
"They say an Indian can imitate any sound," Gus remarked. "They can fool you into thinking they're a wolf, or a coyote, or an owl, or a cricket."
"I doubt a Comanche would pretend to be a cricket," Carl said.
"Well, locusts then," Gus said. "Locusts buzz. You get a bunch of them buzzing and it's hard to hear."
Again they heard the wolf, and again the coyote.
"It's Indians talking," Gus said. "They're talking an animal."
"We don't know, though," Carl said. "I seen a wolf just yesterday. There's plenty of coyotes, too. Could just be animals."
"No, it ain't. It's Comanches," Gus said, standing up. "Let's go shoot one. I expect if we killed three or four, the major would raise our wages."
Carl thought it was bold thinking. They were already a good distance from camp. The campfire was only a faint flicker behind them. Clouds had begun to come in, hiding the stars. Suppose they went farther and got caught. All the tortures Bigfoot had described might be visited on them. Besides, their orders were to stand watch, not to go Indian hunting.
"I ain't going," Carl said. "That ain't what we were supposed to do."
"I doubt that fat fool is a real major anyway," Gus said.
He was restless. Sitting half the night by a bush did not appeal to him much. It was undoubtedly a long way to a whorehouse from where they sat, but at least there might be Indians to fight. Better a fight than nothing. With no more mezcal to drink, his prospects were meager. Carl, though, had not responded to the call of adventure. He was still squatting by the chaparral bush. "Why, Gus, he is too a major," Carl said. "You saw how the soldiers saluted him back in San Antonio."
"Even if he ain't a major, he gave us a job," he reminded his friend. "We're earning $3 a month. Long Bill says we'll get all the Indian fighting we want before we get back to the settlements."
"Bye. I'm going exploring," Gus said. "I've heard there's gold mines out in this part of the country."
Gold mines, Call said. How would you notice a gold mine in the middle of the night, and what would you do with one if you did notice it? You ain't even got a spade.
No, but think of all the whores I could buy if I had a gold mine, Gus said. I could even buy a whorehouse. I'd have 20 girls, and they'd all be pretty. If I didn't feel like letting in no customers, I'd do all the work myself.
With that, he walked off a few steps.
Ain't you coming?
He asked when he heard no footsteps behind him. No, I was told to stand guard, not to go prospecting, Call said. I aim to stand guard till it's my turn to sleep. If you go off and get captured, the major won't like it one bit either, Call reminded him. Neither will you. Remember how that Mexican screamed. Gus left. Woodrow Call was stubborn. Why waste the night arguing with a stubborn man? Gus walked rapidly through the cold night toward where the wolf had howled. It irked him that his friend was so disposed to obey orders. The way he looked at it, being a ranger meant you could range, which was what he intended to do. He thought best to cock his gun, though, in case he was taken by surprise. He had heard men scream while dentists were working on them, but in his experience, no one undergoing dentistry had screamed half as loud as the captured Mexican. After strolling nearly 20 minutes through the sandy country, Gus decided to stop and take his bearings. He looked back to see if he could spot the campfire, but the long plain was dark. Thunder had begun to rumble, and in the west there was a flicker of lightning. While he was stopped, he thought he heard something behind him and whirled in time to spot a badger not 3 feet away. The badger was bumbling along, not watching where it was going. Gus didn't shoot it, but he did kick at it. He was irritated at the animal for startling him so. It was the kind of thing that could affect a man's nerves, and it affected his. Because of the badger's intrusion, Gus felt a strong urge to get back to his guard post. Walking around at night didn't accomplish much. It was annoying that Woodrow Call had been too dull to accompany him. On the walk back, Gus tried to think of some adventure he could describe that would make his friend envious. The campfire had not yet come in sight. Probably the rangers had been too lazy to gather sufficient firewood and had let the fire burn down. Gus began to wonder if he was holding a true course. It was hard to see landmarks on a starless night, and there were precious few landmarks in that part of the country anyway. Of course, the river was in the direction he was walking, but the river twisted and curved. If he just depended on the river, he might end up several miles from camp. He might even miss breakfast, or what passed for breakfast. While he was walking, the wolf howled again. Gus decided it was probably just a wolf after all. The boredom of guard duty had caused him to imagine it was a Comanche. He felt some irritation. The wolf had distracted him with its howling, and now he was beginning to get the feeling that he was lost. He had always believed that he had a perfect sense of direction. Even when he was put off on a mud bar in the middle of the Mississippi River, he didn't get lost. He walked straight on to Dubuque. Of course, it was not hard to find Dubuque. It was there in plain sight on its bluff. But there were willow thickets and some heavy underbrush between the river and the town. If he had been drunk, he might well have gotten lost and ended up pointed toward St. Louis or somewhere. Instead, he had strolled straight into Dubuque and had persuaded a bartender to draw him a mug of beer. It had been a thirsty trip on the old boat. The Iowa beer had tasted good. Now, though, there was no Mississippi and no bluff. He could walk for a month in any direction and not find a town the size of Dubuque or a bartender willing to draw him a mug of beer just because he showed up and asked. He'd only owned his weapons for 3 weeks and so far had not been able to hit anything he shot at, although he believed he might have winged a wild turkey back along the Colorado River. He might walk around Texas until he starved, due to his inability to hit the kind of game they had in Texas. It was skittery game, for the most part. Back in Tennessee, the deer were almost as docile as cows, and almost as fat. He had killed two or three from the back porch of the old home place, whereas here in Texas, deer hardly let you get within a mile of them. Gus stopped and listened for a bit. Sometimes the rangers sang at night. There had been plenty of whooping and dancing the night they drank the mezcal. He felt if he listened, he might hear Josh Korn's harmonica or some other music. Black Sam sometimes let loose with his darky hymns when he was in low spirits. Sam had a full voice and could be heard a long way even when he was singing low. But when Gus stopped to listen, the plain around him was absolutely silent, so silent that the silence itself rang in his ears. The night was as dark as it was silent, too. Gus could see nothing at all, except intermittently when the lightning flickered. It was because of the lightning that he had spotted the offensive badger that had managed to affect his nerves. He took a few steps and stopped. After all, it wouldn't be night forever, and he'd not gone that far from camp. The simplest thing to do would be to wrap up good in his San Antonio serape and sleep for a few hours. With dawn at his back, he could be in camp in a few minutes. If he kept walking, he might veer off into the great emptiness.